listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. In this podcast series, we bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. The Draper Hills Summer Fellowship Program brings together leaders from around the world who are working to advance democracy. One of those leaders is Hoi Trinh, who joins us today. He was born in Vietnam and now advocates for democracy and civil society development through VOICE, the Vietnamese Overseas Initiative for Conscience Empowerment, which he co-founded in 2005. Welcome, Hoi, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for letting me in on this program.
So first off, help us understand what's happening in Vietnam today. Tell us a little bit about the people that you're trying to help.
Let's split them into two groups. VOICE is first and foremost trying to find a durable solution for refugees from Vietnam. For some of the listeners right now, I think that they may be aware that there was a boat people exodus that started at the end of the Vietnam War in 1975. And at the height of it, there were hundreds of thousands of refugees from Vietnam stranded in refugee camps in Southeast Asia. And that's how I got involved in this sort of pro bono work. But the second part of my work is to help develop civil society and therefore democracy in Vietnam.
So can you tell us a bit about your background? I know you were born in Vietnam. Why did your family leave?
You know, There's no sort of straightforward answer as to why I am doing what I'm doing now. I think for, I guess, most of us, it would be like one thing leads to another. In my case, I was born in Vietnam in 1970 in a country that no longer exists, the Republic of Vietnam, commonly referred to as South Vietnam. Because of that, in 1975, when I was 5 years old, when the North Communists came down and won the war and invaded South Vietnam, the entire country became communist. And because my family is from the South, we're from Saigon, like millions of other South Vietnamese, we were persecuted because my mom was a teacher, my dad was in the army. As a result of that, he was sent to re-education camp for 3 years. And then after his release, our family was not allowed to live in Saigon. And instead, we were sent to a new economic zone, which is a kind of tool that the government used to get rid of the intellectual people and to create this utopian society. So our family was relocated to a very remote island in South Vietnam. From where my dad escaped by boat to Thailand in 1980, and then a few months later, he got resettled in Australia.
And when your family followed him to Australia, what was that like for you?
When I got to Australia in 1985, because dad, it took him 5 years to sponsor us over, that was the first time that I started sort of asking questions regarding where I'm from, and then why I had to go to Australia. I mean, because from the age of 5 to the age of 15, I only had that reality, which was Vietnam post-war.
Sure.
But without a father. So he wasn't around because, I mean, he was in prison and then he escaped by boat to Australia. I think for that, the first, from the age of 5 to the age of 15, I had a rough childhood, peaceful upbringing because, you know, we had to go to an island. I mean, my first memories, childhood memories, were of me visiting dad in prison.
Wow.
And then were of me working in the field and seeing how my mom was very bad at farming because she was a teacher. Mm-hmm. And then my dad was also an English teacher, but he wasn't allowed to teach again. So then they were forced to work as farmers. And let me tell you, teachers are not good farmers. That's what I learned.
Sure.
Because my mom and my dad were not very good farmers. They couldn't quite grow the potatoes that other farmers were able to grow because they were teachers. So growing up in Vietnam, I guess I was too young to really have questions in my mind. I sort of like, and just like hundreds of thousands of other kids that grew up in similar situations, we sort of just grew up and thought, okay, well, this is the life that we lead. And then I got to Australia as a teenager. And for the first few years, it was all about assimilation. You know, it was all about integration because, you know, when you go to a place like the US, Australia, what you have to do is you have to assimilate because you have to be one of them. You don't want to be seen as an outcast. You don't want to be seen as like someone who couldn't integrate into the society. So then you really don't think about your past. You don't really think about why you got there. And I guess in the rush towards adulthood and assimilation, I didn't really think much about it until I got to university. And so I got to law school, Melbourne University Law School, 4 years after I arrived in Australia. And then by sheer luck, I got a chance to go to Hong Kong to volunteer. And you know, got to work with a wonderful human rights lawyer, and her name was Pam Baker. And for the first time in my life, at the age of 21, I then started to understand why there was this boat people exodus, why my dad had to leave Vietnam, and where I really am from, right? Because throughout my teenage years, I would try to say that I'm from Australia, right? First of all, because when all refugees leave their homeland, that's it. They would leave the homeland behind. They won't go back. I mean, in the early 80s, when my dad left and then when my family left, we never would imagine that one day we would return to Vietnam, right? It was like, this place is so bad, we have to go, and then we will never look back. So not only that, at the age of 21, I managed to learn about the plight of the Vietnamese refugees, and therefore the history of Vietnam. It was also, at the same time, I started having questions about my identity. Like, so who am I? So where am I really from? Because usually, you know, you have friends and they'll say, so where are you from? And you say, I'm from Australia. And they'll say, no, where are you really from? And say, okay. Originally, I'm from Vietnam. So those questions, it doesn't just happen in your daily life. It happens, you know, as time goes by, as you grow into an adult, you started asking your questions. So because of that, and because I had my sort of background by default, and then by luck, I had a chance to work in refugee camps and to understand the issues. When I graduated from Melbourne University Law School and I got a job at Baker McKenzie, which is the largest law firm in the world, I wasn't too satisfied. You know, yes, on the one hand, getting a job at Baker McKenzie was a prestigious thing for an immigrant kid, a refugee kid to get into, but it wasn't satisfied enough because it couldn't answer those questions. Why are, at the time, I asked myself, why are there more than 100,000 refugees stuck in Hong Kong? They are my people. I could have been one of them. And the second question is, well, if these questions are so important, this question is even more important. Am I really from Australia, right? Why am I here? So because of those questions, it led me to leave Baker McKenzie and then to the refugee camps in Hong Kong, then in the Philippines, and then Thailand.
So you, in 2005, co-founded Voice. Is that when your civil society work began?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, so by 2005, I had spent approximately 8 years in the Philippines fighting for these stateless refugees. At the time, there were 3,000 Vietnamese asylum seekers there who were left stateless by the UN. And they had no home to go to. Vietnam wouldn't take them back. The resettlement countries wouldn't take them. And then the Philippines, it's not a resettlement country. So I started asking a lot of questions about, okay, so usually we blame the international community for failing to do this and that. But is it really the international community's obligation? No, I mean, to a certain extent, no, it's not. Why do they have to help refugees? Then I looked at Vietnam, and I realized that, you know what? It's actually whenever you need to solve something, you've got to solve the basic problem as to why refugees flee. They flee because of persecution. They flee because of war, because of famine. But that's the root cause. It's not because of the international community's failure to help refugees. No. At the end of the day, it is the problem of the source country, which is Vietnam. And so instead of sort of trying to blame others and looking for answers elsewhere, I started saying, until and unless Vietnam changes and becomes a democratic country, we will continue to have refugees.
So is that what inspired you to go back to Vietnam?
In answering, in wanting to answer the question as to who I am, I really wanted to go back to Vietnam. And so I decided to go back to Vietnam. In an authoritarian state like Vietnam, where there's only one party, that is the Communist Party, it dawned on me that even when you don't think about politics, politics will think about you. And because of my, you know, human rights background, the work that I've done to help Vietnamese refugees, when I went back to Vietnam in 2007, the Vietnamese authority started to interrogate me. Under Vietnamese law, I'm considered as a Vietnamese. And so during their investigation, for 6 months, I could not travel. And I remember this sort of incident when I went to the airport and I wanted to go to the U.S. because I had, at the time, I was married. And I wanted to go back to visit my family because my then wife and kid were in the U.S., in L.A., and I couldn't go. Mm-hmm. And I just went to the airport and said, no, you're not allowed to leave. And there was no letter saying that I cannot leave. It was just word of mouth. I was just told that I couldn't go. It was for the first time in my life I felt helpless. And I remember thinking, hang on here. So I'm a Melbourne University law graduate, an Oxford graduate, a very sort of successful lawyer, and I was working for Ernst & Young, one of the biggest management consultancy firms in Vietnam. I had money, I had knowledge, but there's nothing that I could do. And there's nothing that anyone could do. My family couldn't do anything about it. My parents couldn't do anything about it. So it dawned on me that if this could happen to me, what's going to happen to the ordinary guys on the street, right? It means that once you're in a state like that, in an authoritarian state, it will grind you to the ground. Despite you not having anything to do with politics, you haven't done anything. And at the time, I wasn't even doing anything that was could be remotely said to be democratic involvement. So because of those personal experiences, when they finally finished the investigation, I was given 48 hours to leave Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And when I left Vietnam, I decided that, I'm going to do something more than just a humanitarian undertaking. Because in Vietnam, you will continue to have refugees. And I will never be able to resolve the refugee issue in Vietnam. Two, given my personal experience, I strongly believed in the fact that you need to fundamentally change the system. And so since then, and up until now, that's what I've been focusing on, that as the founder of Voice, we provide a capacity building training to activists, both in Vietnam and outside of Vietnam, to provide logistical, financial, and legal support to the independent civil society organizations in Vietnam and to advocates for political prisoners in Vietnam.
So you're still spending a lot of time working in Vietnam. I'm sure it must be challenging for you to do that kind of work without being able to go back and visit. Can you tell us about some of the challenges that you've faced working outside of the country?
There are many challenges, but then they are at the same time also opportunities. The challenges are that I'm not in Vietnam right now, so I'm not able to be with my friends and colleagues, the one that share the same ideals. Two days ago, a human rights colleague got sentenced to 9 years in prison. Her name is Trang Thị Nga, and leaving her two young children behind. Last month, another colleague of mine, another female activist, got a sentence of 10 years imprisonment for blogging. She also has two children leaving behind. So I wouldn't call it a challenge, but it is a shame that I couldn't be with them, even to be at the court protesting against their conviction. But maybe it is not a challenge, because you know what? Yes, it's hard. Yes, my colleagues are in prison. But that is exactly why I'm doing what I'm doing right now. I cannot imagine myself going back to Baker McKenzie or Ernst & Young. For me, if there were no such challenges like imprisonment of bloggers in Vietnam, no political prisoners in Vietnam, you know what? I probably will have a very boring life. I probably won't be at Stanford. Let's put it that way. You know, I probably will have a very corporate existence in Sydney somewhere or even in Vietnam. But do I really want that life? No, I don't. So yes, they are challenges, but they're not really challenges. They're actually incentives for me to do what I'm doing now.
So that brings us to the reason you're here, Draper Hills. A quick introduction for our listeners. The Draper Hills Summer Fellowship is a 3-week training program hosted by FSI's Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law. Stanford faculty from across campus provide instruction for leaders like yourself who are trying to promote democratic change in their home countries. How do you think your experiences at Stanford will help your work in Vietnam?
On a few fronts, I would say. Let's put it in perspective. Because I'm always on the ground, so I'm right now based in Manila and sometimes Bangkok, I get really involved in the day-to-day operation of Voice and in the management of not just staff, but also programs that we run in support of democracy in Vietnam. Because of that, I could only focus on Vietnam. And I don't have this macro understanding of other problems in the world, how they are solving their own problems. And then not just on a practical level, but on a theoretical level. So on a macro level, you sort of take a step back and you look at it with a bigger picture understanding of it. Number two, you actually get to talk to the leading scholars in the world on the concepts of democracy and how democratic transitions happen. Not everything has turned into rosy conclusions. There are sort of problems within transitions. And how to find sort of creative solutions. That's number two. Number three, you learn from your fellows about the different creative solutions that they have come up with. And I think the last thing would be just the networking. I would say, although it is not often mentioned in textbooks, you know, there's no theory on networking, but I actually think networking will play a very big role in the formation of a person, and therefore in how that person, and how that leads to that person's activities. What I'm trying to say is the wider the network the person has, the more successful the person's work might become successful. But I think that by going to Stanford and meeting up with like a wide range of people, like, you know, I think I'm going to be lectured by Condoleezza Rice. Last week we met with the founder of Google. Today we got lectured by the former ambassador to Russia. I mean, the wealth of knowledge is one thing, but the wisdom and the fact that they can help you understand your problem better, and then somehow they're going to be able to even put you in touch with like-minded people like you. Like, so, you know, today I remember we talked a lot about the Middle East. It has nothing to do with Vietnam. However, I bet you they might know people that might work in Asia that are working on the same issues, and therefore those people can help me. So it's the networking, to me, is very important.
So we've heard about a lot of the amazing things you've done in your life, but there's one thing we haven't talked about yet. You were a torchbearer in the 2000 Sydney Summer Olympics. How did that happen? And tell us what it was like.
Honestly, I have no idea how it happened. So in 1997, when I was still young, I was awarded the Young Vietnamese Australian of the Year. You know, it's one of those awards given in Australia. And then a couple of years later, I was given another award by the Law Council of Australia because of my pro bono work helping refugees in Southeast Asia. And I guess because of sort of that profile, I was nominated by someone or by some organizations, and then I was chosen. So I was in the Philippines working in refugee camps as just a lawyer. And then one day I just got a letter from the Olympics organizing committee saying, hey, you've been selected as a torchbearer, and you need to, you know, be there and run for it. And I'm like, okay. It was fun. I still have the torch at home. For every torchbearer, we had a choice of keeping it. But you would have to pay $80 for it. And I still remember I didn't have $80 because I was paid $100 a month for my pro bono service in the Philippines. So I had no money to pay for it. So my mom had to fork out $80 to pay for it. So right now, the torch is still at home. So yeah, that's the only thing I can remember.
Yeah.
I still have the Sydney 2000 torch.
Very cool. All right. Well, back to our more serious discussion. If anyone wants to know more about the work that you're doing in Vietnam or how they can help, what should they do?
Well, there are a lot of things they could do. It depends on whether they want to chip in a bit of their knowledge or their training or going to the Philippines to volunteer. It really depends on their capacity and how much they want to do it and for how long. First of all, please learn more about our work. They can go to our website, which is vietnamvoice.org. Vietnam is just like V-I-E-T-N-A-M, and then voice, V-O-I-C-E, one word, .org. Or they can email me, which is my name, hoishoitrinh, H-O-I-T-R-I-N-H, @gmail.com. Please learn more about what's happening in Vietnam. And I would love to hear, especially from those who, you know, were really involved in the Vietnam War in like 4 decades ago, right? I really want to find out why is it that Vietnam became such a topic in the 60s and 70s. And then suddenly when the Vietnam War ended, we continue to have human rights violations. Hundreds of thousands of boat people died on the high sea. Yet, it doesn't feature in the international media anymore. You know, now these days, we hear a lot about the Middle East and China. And I'm not saying that those do not warrant our attention. They are big problems. But you know what? In terms of political repression, Vietnam is worse than Burma. In terms of human rights violations, it's worse than Burma. Yet, Burma has received the attention it needs for it to change, not Vietnam. So I would love to hear from those who care about human rights, and especially about human rights in Vietnam vis-a-vis China. Because I still believe that while China is this huge state, that it may be too big of a problem to solve. Vietnam certainly can play a role in the development of not just democracy in Vietnam, but therefore democracy in Asia, and that is China.
Well, you heard him. If you would like to contribute or tell your story or help out, we will have the email address and website address for Voice in the description on this podcast. So please reach out if you'd like to help. And Hoi Trinh, thank you so much for talking with us today.
No, and thank you very much for listening to me. I hope that you will be the change you want to see in the world. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. To learn more about Draper Hills, please visit cddrl.fsi.stanford.edu/summerfellows or follow us on Twitter @FSI Stanford for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.